Hello and welcome to episode 16 of our little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas and I'm here as ever with my co-host David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, Perry. How's things?
Not too bad. We're running a little late on this one, David, as you well know, because we had a little trouble getting our schedules lined up. My internet was working really poorly yesterday. I think they're trying to roll out NBN in my local area and not making it very easy for the rest of us while that's going on.
That doesn't sound good.
Well, it's a long and detailed problem of NBN, as I well know, given I worked for them for a little while, so I won't say any more, just in case I get in a bit of trouble.
It's a pretty sad situation where most people, when they get notified that they're going to get the NBN, go, oh, God, no.
Yes, because you spent so long trying to get your previous internet connections working properly, that once you've actually got it there, you don't want anybody to mess up with it and play around with it, because all you're going to end up doing is getting something that's slower and worse.
Yeah.
And we don't want that. No. But anyway, let's hope that we get through all okay. And I think we probably will.
Yeah.
Things seem to be working all right at the moment, which is a good thing.
Indeed.
So what have you been reading lately, David?
What have I been reading lately? Well, some interesting things. One of them is quite an old book, but in a new edition, I guess, is what you'd say, and that's Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman. That was originally came out in 1996 as a companion to the TV series Neverwhere, which was written, I find, by Neil Gaiman and Lenny Henry. So, but then the book came out. I think over the years there's been a number of editions of the book, and I think Gaiman keeps expanding it. The very latest one I've got is called the Author's Preferred Edition, which I think is added a lot of material to from what was in the TV series. I've never actually seen the TV series. Have you?
No. I haven't read the book either. So.
Well, the book is worth reading, I think. Anyway, the particular edition I now own is really lovely because it's lavishly illustrated by Chris Riddle, who's illustrated a lot of Gaiman's books. It's a lovely style to his drawings. And when I say lavishly, I mean it's not just full-page illustrations, but almost every page has got drawings crowded into the margins. It's almost like someone's given him a physical copy of the book and he's doodled in the margins of the book. But they're all really interesting little drawings, and then there are these full-page drawings. So it's really a beautiful-looking book. But anyway, just to recap the story, the story is that of Richard Mayhew, who's a young man who's moved to London to work for a large corporation, but he's very disenchanted with his life. Things aren't going well. He's not very happy, even with his engagement to Julia, who's an attractive socialite. But he's bumbling, error-prone. He keeps making mistakes. He forgets to book dinner when they're supposed to be meeting with his boss, and a whole lot of things like that. So he's really disenchanted with his life. So it's a typical hero's journey sort of thing. He gets hauled out of his odd everyday life because he's walking down the street with Julia actually one night, and suddenly some sort of portal opens and this young woman falls to his feet bleeding and unconscious, and his girlfriend just wants to walk away and leave her, you know, some homeless person that somehow appeared there, but he wants to look after this poor unconscious young woman and takes her back to his flat, much to Julia's disgust. Anyway, it turns out that she is called Door, as in, you know, the door you open and close, and she's from a place called London below is the world she's from, and there is this literally this fantastic world beneath the streets of London, which Richard finds himself sucked into by his connection with Door. She disappears, and he tries to follow her, and then he finds that his whole life is falling apart. Nobody even seems to know who he is. His desk is cleared at the office, all that sort of thing. Anyway, he eventually finds his way to London below, and connects up with Dora again. But he has a lot of fun. Gaiman has a lot of fun with place names, London place names, and turning them into real locations or real people. So, for example, Knightsbridge is the Knights Bridge, which is a hazardous crossing of a place, and some of them are people. So the Angel Islington is actually a real angel. There's a character called Old Bailey who lives on the top of the law courts, And there's a group called the Black Friars, who were an abbey full of black friars. And you get to there by going on the underground and getting off at the appropriate underground station. And then there's the Earl's Court, which is actually a medieval court ruled by an earl, but it's all within a rattling railway carriage running around on the underground. So it's a lot of fun, but there's some very terrifying bits, because Dory's being pursued by these really, really, really creepy assassins who are out to get her. And so there's a lot of running away and hiding and trying to fight back against these people. So it's, as I say, a typical hero's journey. He goes through a transformation and comes out a wholly different sort of character, a much better character, before he's returned to the everyday world. But it's a lot of fun. I enjoyed it quite a lot. I don't much generally like fantasy, as I've said before, pure fantasy, but this was one which really connected with me, and I liked it a lot. So that's worth doing.
Seems there's a wealth of opportunity for authors with old and ancient cities like London that have been around for a long period of time. There's the Rivers of London series.
Yes. Yes, there's some similarities.
I'm not sure if you've come across that. So there's some similarities there. And I know that Elliot de Baudard has done some things with Paris. I think there's a lot of opportunity. So this sounds like it, especially for those people that know anything about London at all, get the insider jokes.
Yeah, that's right. There's sounds like probably pretty quite good. A few insider jokes in there, which even I don't get because I'm not a Londoner, but it's fun. Oh, I read, I think you recommended this to me, or it was one on the Hugo list or something. You were the one who mentioned it to me, which is Every Heart a Doorway by Seanan McGuire.
Sinan McGuire.
I don't know how to pronounce Irish names. I must confess, I find it hard to work out. So, have you read that one? Every Heart a Doorway. I didn't much like it, to be perfectly honest. I mean, it's certainly intended as a young adult book, and it's based around a school for children who have had some sort of extraordinary experience where they've fallen out, a bit like Richard Mayhew, have fallen out of the everyday world and gone through some sort of portal into a fantastic realm. And for each child, it seems to be a different fantastic realm, but although they fall into sort of categories. It's not a bad concept, but I didn't think the execution was all that good, because you never get to visit any of these strange worlds. All you ever do is hear about them through the voices of these children. And so even the introduction of a serial killer at the school campus doesn't actually spark up the story all that much for me. So no, I didn't much like it. So I probably won't be following up on the sequels.
Well, this is a novella, so you have to take it from the idea that it's constrained by its original concept in terms of size. So we're only talking 100, 120 odd pages, somewhere around
something
there.
Something like that, yeah.
I thought it was pretty good. I seem to recall it won a few awards when it was out a couple of years ago. There's been 4 or 5 sequels, all novellas, so she seems to be writing a sequence of novellas all set in the same sort of background and in the same world.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed this, David. Yeah, I thought this one was pretty good.
Matter of taste.
It was excellent.
Absolutely.
But basically, I know that if you were not necessarily a big fan of fantasy or this sort of style, that yes, you could understand that, you know, maybe it isn't to your taste, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot.
That's fine. I say it's a matter of taste, and we all have different tastes, and that's a good thing.
If you didn't like this one, I wouldn't basically bother about the sequels.
No, I don't think I'll be following them up. No,
I don't think the sequels are up to the standard of this one.
Yeah.
So if you're not overly keen on this one, you can probably kiss the other ones goodbye. Move on to something else.
I've got a few other things I could talk about, but the one that we both read. Do you want to talk about the books you've been reading, and then we can go back?
Yeah, there's
one we've both read together, both equally have read.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of books that I wanted to have a chat about. These were two books that I didn't read with this particular thought in mind, but I only found out later on that they were basic. They basically have a sort of a subject matter in common, which is cinema and film. They're both fantasy slash horror/ghost stories. One's a pure fantasy, one's a sort of fantasy come ghost story, contemporary ghost story. Both of them didn't probably get the recognition that they should have gotten, although one probably borderline, probably received more than it should. The other one, experimental film, received less than it should. So anyway, it didn't quite work out the way that it should have gone in terms of their quality and the way that I liked them. Anyway, the first of the ones I read was Borderline by Michelle Baker from 2016. This was nominated for both Nebula and World Fantasy Awards, and also, sorry, I should say, it was also nominated for the Mythopoeic Fantasy Award and was a finalist for the Tiptree Award. So it's one of those ones that did pick up a fair bit of recognition, but it didn't win any of the awards. It's basically, it's the first in a trilogy called the Arcadia Project, and it centres around a particular person who is an experimental filmmaker, has, although experimental film is the name of the second book, but this woman is a up-and-coming filmmaker who falls into a fairly disastrous relationship with her university tutor and has a bad falling out and actually decides to try and kill herself. She wakes up with basically her her legs that are completely shattered, and she ends up having to have at least one leg removed and a steel prosthetic leg put there in its place. Now, somehow or other, she starts to notice that there is somebody following her, and then she finds that there's somebody else following her, and she can't quite work out what all this is until one of them makes contact and finds and offers her a job working with the Arcadia Project. Now, this is a project that looks after the interactions between the human world and the fairy world.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing here with Hollywood, and one of the main premises of this particular novel is that the major players in Hollywood all have a fairy companion who is actually in human form, who basically gives them all the drive, all the inspiration to be able to produce the films that they make. Now, what happens in this particular film is that a movie star goes missing, and it appears that there is a interaction that has gone on between fairy and the human worlds, which isn't working as well as it should. And the Arcadia Project people are there to try and smooth things over. So it turns into a missing persons murder mystery sort of arrangement. But I don't know, I struggled with this a bit. I really didn't really feel as though it engaged me all that much. I got to the end of it and thought, it was fine. Perfectly frank, I don't know why it was nominated for all these awards. Wasn't as good as I would have thought a nominee for a Nebula Award should be.
Indeed.
But I just can't see myself going on and reading the other two in the trilogy. I've read this one. That'll do.
Yeah.
Now, the other one, which is also about film, is called Experimental Film by Gemma Files. This is from 2015. Now, this one won the 2016 Shirley Jackson Award. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware of the Shirley Jackson Award or not. It's one of those I shouldn't say minor awards, but if we talk about the major awards in the field as being the Hugo, the Nebula, the Locus, the World Fantasy Award, there's a whole lot of other awards that are at a sort of a secondary level that don't get as much publicity as those big ones do. But you were talking a while back about books that don't necessarily get the recognition that they deserve.
Yeah.
Some of them fall down into these other categories and get picked up there.
Yes,
this one in particular, which is a contemporary ghost story, won the Shirley Jackson Award, which is presented for, I'm thinking it's a bit like the Philip K. Dick Award for books that would be written in a form that would be similar to that of Phil Dick or of that sort of genre, subgenre, if you like. In this instance, we're talking Shirley Jackson, who wrote The Haunting of Hill House, talking about ghost stories, slightly terror-related, but not full-blast horror, certainly not splatter horror. There's not a lot of... there's more tension and the build-up of suspense here, rather than all-out visceral horror that you would normally get. So anyway, this Canadian film history teacher, Lois Cairns, discovers evidence of a lost early 20th century Canadian filmmaker called Malala Whitcomb, and realises that there's a possibility here of being able to rewrite the whole of the history of Canadian filmmaking throughout the 20th century, because this woman was doing a lot of work producing a lot of films which seemed to have gone missing. Now, so she decides that she's going to do some research into this and try and work out what's going on. And as she goes on and does some more research, she starts coming across information about this particular woman which is really quite strange. Malala Whitcomb grew up in a Canadian farming community and was the sole survivor of a very strange incident that took the lives of the rest of her family. Her mother had passed on by that stage, but I believe there's a younger sibling, a father and a grandmother, and all of them are Malala Whitcomb, or Malala, because Whitcomb's a married name, I believe. But anyway, all of them, other than Malala, were found dead in a field out in the middle of a wheat field in the middle of summer. And it, by the looks of things, they'd been there for 2 or 3 days. Bit of research that Lois Cairns does, and she comes to the realisation that these people were probably visited by a spiritual being called Lady Midday, or the Noon Witch.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking earlier about Neil Gaiman. If you remember with American Gods, the major thing about American Gods that Gaiman wrote is that the immigrants from Europe brought their gods and spirits with them.
Yes.
And therefore they manifested themselves, those spirits and gods manifested themselves in the mythology of North America. Same thing happens here. The Lady Midday, or the Noon Witch, is a spirit or a mythical being that appears in the midday sun generally to farmers who are out and about doing work, who basically have suffered a form of heat stroke, if you like, and start seeing visions. And the visions they see is those of Lady Midday or the Noon Witch. These myths originated in the Slavic countries and have been transported with the immigrants that have come from those countries over into Canada. So the similar sort of arrangement that happens here. I'd never heard of the Lady Midday of the Doon Witch, so I had to basically look it up. Very interesting concept.
So it's a real thing. It hasn't been invented by the author of this
book.
No,
no, no. No, this is actually a myth of the Slavic countries, and it goes to explain those hallucinations that people would get if they were out working very hard in the midday sun and get heat stroke and start seeing visions, and they start seeing visions of this woman. Basically, the story goes that the woman will ask you a question, and if you answer the question correctly, and by that I mean politely and not make eye contact and just basically answer her intelligently, she will allow you to live. If you just basically dismiss her, tell her to go away, tell her that she's not wanted here, and you're rude or impolite, she'll kill you.
Yeah.
So basically what happens is that it seems like this woman, Malala Whitcomb, was her family was visited by this witch. Everybody died, but she survived. She then goes on to try to explore this whole concept. This is Malala Whitcomb, goes on to try to explore this whole concept of the Noonday Witch in the films that she makes. Lois Cairns, in our present time, finds some of these films and starts to realise that there's a whole heap of connections between Whitcomb and her life. She realises that both of them have got a son that's on the autistic spectrum. Whitcomb's son completely goes missing and is lost and is never found. And it's a very interesting book. It deals with an interesting new concept of a ghost concept that I hadn't come across before, which I, so I thought it was pretty good. Some people have been, I've read a few of the reviews on Goodreads. Some people absolutely hated this book, absolutely hated it. Said it was slow, boring, took far too long on giving details and of the history of Canadian film. And yet I didn't have a problem with it at all. I mean, I just thought it was an excellent excellent contemporary ghost story. And I think it was a worthy winner of the Shirley Jackson Award in the year it was received. So I'd recommend this one.
Okay.
I wouldn't recommend so much Borderline.
No.
Interesting, but you have to like that sort of fairy interaction between the human world and the fairy world. I wasn't overly keen on it.
That's interesting. The that kind of structure where you have a researcher digging into the past and then and slowly uncovering things which start to shock him or her is an interesting one. It's been used a few times. As you were talking, I was thinking about The Blood Doctor by Barbara Vine, who was a pseudonym of Ruth Rendell. And that's where someone who's a descendant of a particular guy who was a doctor to Queen Victoria is sort of trying to write a biography of his ancestor. And as he digs more and more into the details of this guy's life and what he did, he starts to realize he can never actually publish this book because of what he reveals. So it's an interesting book. I mean, it's the ending's a bit predictable, but I won't give any spoilers. But it's well worth reading. But that's kind of has that structure of someone in the modern day researching what goes on in the past. And of course, the other one that reminds me of in that way is Possession, where you've got people in the modern day, A.S. Byatt's book, people in the modern day researching the past and uncovering all sorts of things that were unexpected. So it's quite an interesting structure, which has been used a few times.
It's got to be done intelligently, and Possession certainly was.
Yeah, that was very
good. Well, you'd have to say that Possession is a better book than this one because it was so beautifully written and such a fantastic idea and story. But I'd recommend that if you like contemporary ghost stories, that experimental film is one that you should try and track down.
Sure.
It's not that easy to find.
Yeah.
I don't think it got that much publicity when it was originally published back in 2015. But hopefully you'll be able to find it somewhere.
Sure. Okay, that sounds good. Did you want to talk about the book we mentioned last episode and which we've both read, The First 15 Lives of Harry August?
Yep.
Well, certainly, The First 15 Lives of Harry August by Claire North is on my list of the best, certainly best top 10 books I've read this year, probably the top 5 books I've read this year. So it's got this really clever, well, I think it's a really clever concept, that there are certain individuals who they live a normal life and then they die, as we all do. But then these people are reborn, but in their original life. So as the child is growing up, as a toddler and then as a young school-age child, they start to remember their previous life. But it's not a previous life in a different part of time. It's the same character in the same time period remembering their previous go at this life or their previous turn at this life. And this sends a lot of these people crazy because their parents think they're crazy anyway and they get put into asylums and things. So Harry August is one that turns out to be one of these people. And in his second life, he is actually put into a mental asylum for young people and then he commits suicide. But then he's reborn again and comes back. And eventually he starts to discover there are a whole lot of people like this. And they sort of band together to support each other, particularly support them in their perilous childhood years. But the other interesting thing about it is that they don't live exactly the same life every time. They connect upon their memories and change what the kind of life that they're going to that they live. And so it's a very clever concept, and that's why we have the first 15 lives, because we're talking about all these cycles through this particular life. But then the author takes it a step further, and that's that there's a really dark element that there's someone who's trying to manipulate things in a way which is really going to bring the end of human civilization and forward, and I'm not quite sure how to describe that part of it, but it becomes very dark, and Harry starts to treat this character as a real antagonist. They're very antagonistic to each other eventually. They start off as friends, and then they become really absolute antagonists, and there's some very clever twists in the novel. Is that a reasonable sort of summary?
Yes, it is. It reminded me, the book, a bit of a novel that I'd read some time back called Replay by Ken Grimwood, which was published back in 1986, and it won the 1988 World Fantasy Award.
Uh-huh.
Similar sort of concept. In that one, the main character keeps on getting reborn, but I think when he dies, he goes back to another part of his life and relives the life all over again.
Uh-huh.
from that particular point. But this is, I thought this is a really, truly excellent book. Yeah, I thought it was really well handled.
Really well handled, yeah.
Really well handled, really well thought out. I thought it was suspenseful. Claire North, and I don't believe that's the woman's, I think that's a pen name, isn't it?
I think it is a pen name, yeah. I'm not sure what the real name is. I'll look it up while we're talking.
So it did pretty well in the year in which it came out. I read it 2 years ago, 17, I think I read it. And I just had I looked it up, and I had it in the top five of my... Well, I called this a fantasy. I don't know about you.
I guess it is fantasy. Fiction? Well, it is fantasy, but it's kind of, I don't know, would you call it hard fantasy?
This is a real problem with these subgenres. I just call it a fantasy. I mean, to me, it doesn't have something... Let me start again. The way I see this is it fits within that big overall church that we would like to call science fiction and fantasy. It, however, I don't call it science fiction. I believe that it is actually a fantasy novel, but it's sort of a light fantasy. It's not high fantasy in the Tolkien sense. It's an urban fantasy because it's not quite that, but it's a lighter fantasy which has one idea, and they take that and then extrapolate from it. Now, that's normally a technique that you would get in a science fiction novel.
Yeah.
You take one thing that might change in a world, and then you see what happens after you make that change. In this instance, you've got these people that basically keep on getting reborn. And of course, as you said, there are others that keep on getting reborn, but they're not getting reborn all at the same time. So some of them, he's just about to die, I believe, at one instance.
Right at
the start of the book, he's starting to die, and somebody comes into his hospital bed and says, oh, and she's a young girl of about 6 or 8.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad I caught up with you. I thought I was going to miss you.
Yeah.
So there's this 6 or 8-year-old that comes in who knows what's going to be happening in the future, but she only overlaps in a very short period where she can actually communicate with him and pass a message back.
Yeah, back in time. That's a very clever concept. Yeah,
so the idea is that you tell somebody now, they die, they remember everything that they went through in their whole life, including what was told to them by somebody else. And when they start their life again and get to the stage where they get intelligent, all their memories come back. And they realise, oh, I've got to go and do something.
I thought it was
excellent, a hearty recommendation. As I said, I had it in my top five fantasy novels of the year for 2017, and I don't know whether I did a top five all up, but I reckon it probably would have been pretty close to being in that top five as well, across all genres.
Yeah,
I thought it was that good.
Certainly in my top five for this year, for sure. Yeah.
So it's interesting to note that even though you and I would look at this as being a fantasy novel.
Well, you would. I'm still not so sure, but yeah, go on.
Yeah. Anyway, I would. It actually won the John W. Campbell Award, Memorial Award for Best Science Fiction Novel, and was nominated for the Arthur C. Clarke Award for Best Science Fiction Novel. Yeah. So it just goes to show you how much we know, David.
Well, that's true.
Well, how much I know, put it that way.
All right, so there you go. I think you mentioned that she's written some other books that were worth following up on.
Yes, she has. I read The Sudden Appearance of Hope last year again, which I thought was quite an excellent book. It's again a light fantasy touch. I think that uh, I'd it didn't make as much of an impact on me as The First 15 Lives of Harry August. But The Sudden Appearance of Hope, the interesting thing about the title is the main character's name is Hope. So The Sudden Appearance of Hope is that she is a teleporter. She can just jump from one place to another, but she has to be under a fair amount of stress in order for her to be able to do that. But she gradually gets to the point where she's able to control it. I'd have to go back and look at it again. I don't believe it's as good as this First 15 Lives of Harry August. However, it is still worthwhile reading. And I'll be following up on the other books that she's published since then. Again, it's one of those things that, yes, she's an author that I need to read, but there's a whole lot of other things that are on the list, and you can only spend a certain amount of time before you get to the point where you think, well, time to move on to something else.
That's yeah, it's true. I'll certainly be following up on some of her other books, and Wikipedia tells me that her real name is Catherine Webb, W-E-B-B, Catherine Webb, and she's written a lot of books. A lot of them are simple fantasy, and it does actually, and then she's written as Claire North, the Harry August book, one called Touch, which looks interesting, the one you mentioned, A Sudden Appearance of Hope, one called The Games House, and something called The End of the Day. So all those would be interesting to follow up on.
Okay, David, so that's what we've been reading lately. You been watching anything, film, television, anything you can recommend?
Yeah, I've been watching a few things on TV, as they say. These days it's all streaming stuff, and it gets a bit hard to know whether to recommend things or not, because if someone doesn't have that particular streaming service, then it's kind of a bit pointless. But anyway, all I can do is tell you what I've been watching. So what I saw on Amazon Prime, it's an Amazon original series called The Boys. And I really liked it, but there are some, definitely, I would warn people that it has some rather gut-churning violence in it, which you really sort of go, almost in a couple of spots. But nevertheless, it's interesting that the premise is that it's a world which has a large number of superheroes in it with varying powers. And the most powerful of these beings is called Homelander, who's like a Superman-type being. He's got all the ability to fly, and he's got laser eyes and all that sort of stuff. But the twist is that all these superheroes are managed by a wealthy corporation called Vought International. And like any big corporation, their aim in life is to maximize their profits rather than actually help humanity. And they actually lease out these superheroes to various cities to defend the cities against crime and so on. But it's definitely a commercial operation, and it comes with all the bad side effects you would think of large corporations having. And we slowly come to understand also that the heroes, in quotes, are in many cases really deeply flawed people. We start off with a character called Huey, who's a young man who works in a dead-end job in an electronics store. And he's just at the point of planning to move out of home and move in with his girlfriend. But the trigger incident for the story is that his girlfriend is standing in the street and killed instantly when she's run into by a superhero called A-Train, who's like a super-fast, The Flash sort of character, super-fast superhero, and who barely pauses to say sorry after killing this young woman before speeding off again. Huey is devastated and tries to get the Vought Corporation to apologize and give some compensation. But in this, you know, he's actually a bit frustrated in that. And in this state of anger, he's picked up by a guy called Billy Butcher, who's played by Carl Urban. And Butcher's got a long-standing vendetta against Homelander, who he believes raped and maybe murdered his wife, who's disappeared entirely. And so he gathers together a group of people, including Huey, who he calls the Boys, to fight these soups, these superheroes. But because these are just ordinary human beings pitched against these superheroes with superpowers, they have to take very drastic and sometimes very ugly measures to try and succeed. And poor old Huey gets in deeper and deeper, and things start to turn very dark. But I also liked in it the character Annie, who's a young, innocent young woman who becomes the superhero Starlight, who's been pushed forward, just like young people are pushed forward to appear in movies or to go on the ballet or whatever. She's been pushed forward by an ambitious mother who wants her to become a famous superhero. And eventually she's overjoyed to be chosen as one of the seven who are the sort of the top group of superheroes in this world. But then she is very quickly disabused of her dreams of selfless public service, and she starts to realize that the seven are not really the ethical, wonderful heroes sent by God that she thought they were. So I think it's a very clever concept, and it's very well done. But I say, I do warn you that there are a couple of bits of really stomach-churning violence, which you kind of might want to skip by or something. Anyway, it was a lot of fun, but then that's just the first season, and I believe there will be a second season, so I'm looking forward to that. So that's what I've been seeing.
A couple of major new TV series in the science fiction and fantasy genre started about a month ago, one started about 5 or 6 weeks ago. The first one that I've been watching is Watchmen. This is a TV series following up on the original comic and then the movie that was made of that original comic. Graphic novel, comic. I'm okay with that. I don't have a problem about calling graphic novels comics. I'm a comics fan. It doesn't particularly bother me one way or the other. although some people I know do like to make the distinction. I'm all right with it. Anyway, so the television series is set 34 years after the events of the graphic novel and the film. There have been six episodes so far. I've seen the first five. I'm going to withhold my judgment. I've been having a few conversations on Facebook about this particular series. I'm worried that the writer may not necessarily be able to bring it all together. One of the problems I had with the Ridley Scott film Prometheus, which we spoke about a while back, was the script. The writer of that film, Prometheus, is also the main writer of this particular television series. And so I'm a little bit worried about this one. Damon Lindelof, I think his name is. I think he also wrote the TV series Lost some years back, which started out really well, but it just seemed to be obscurity's sake. The thing, bits and pieces jumping around all over the place that seemed to make absolutely no sense. And I don't think that he bought, from what I heard, I lost track of Lost. I didn't basically keep watching it throughout the whole all of the seasons. But those people that I do know that watched it basically said their major criticism was that he didn't really bring it all together all that well at the end. And I'm worried that he's going to do exactly the same thing here.
Now, you could say the same about Game of Thrones, couldn't you, I believe, from what I hear?
Well, you could.
So maybe it's a standard thing.
I thought that one came together okay. However, we could have a big, big, long discussion about that one as well later on. But in this instance, I'm going to withhold my judgment on the basis that we're only about halfway through the first season. I think it is worthwhile watching if you are a fan of the Watchmen graphic novel or film. Then I specifically think it's worth people watching.
Yep.
It's available in Australia on Foxtel. So if you don't have Foxtel, you're probably going to have to wait until the DVD comes out.
Yep.
Well, this is a bit of a problem. You were saying that you think it's probably not worthwhile, maybe not worthwhile talking about films that people can't get a hold of. Well, I think we should still talk about it, because maybe then that people will be able to say, well, I'll just wait until the DVD series comes out and it's released the whole lot and I can sit down and binge watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, what this particular TV series, I think, will probably benefit from a binge watch.
Mm.
I think there's things going on that I'm missing from one week to the next that I'm not. I'm finding it a bit difficult to follow, finding it difficult to work out what the point of it is. But as I said, I'll hold off until we actually get to the point where we're at the end, and then I'll come back to it again. Now, the other one that I'm looking at is the television adaptation of the first novel in the His Dark Materials series by Philip Pullman.
Yes, big fan. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, so am I as well. And this is actually called His Dark Materials. Again, I'm not entirely sure it's working as well as it could, but I've only got two episodes in, and I think that probably have to withhold judgment on this one as well.
Yep.
So while I've been watching it, unfortunately, we haven't got to the end of things yet, can't really give a definitive answer, because some of the criticisms you might have now may disappear later.
Yeah, sure. The it's interesting really talking about Watchmen after I've just finished talking about The Boys, because I suppose there are some similarities, because the concept of they're being superheroes, but they're seriously flawed human beings and have their own agendas for things, and so there's some similarities there. But Watchmen, I very much like the graphic novel, which was of course written by Alan Moore, who was one of those people who wrote some brilliant comic books, let's call them comic books, and along with Neil Gaiman. So there's some very good material there that he wrote.
I think it's very worthwhile watching, especially if you are a fan.
Yeah.
If you're not a fan, you're probably going to struggle a little bit, but hey, there's a couple of major events in science fiction and fantasy television at the moment. So certainly worthwhile talking about, certainly worthwhile watching. And we'll come back to them both at the end when they're both finished.
Sure.
And I'll let you know what I think about them then.
Yeah, the same goes for what I'm watching too on Apple TV Plus, the new service, Apple TV Plus, which is For All Mankind. I'm only sort of three episodes in so far, but that's the concept where, in fact, the Russians beat the Americans to the moon in 1969. The first landing on the moon is by a Russian cosmonaut, I should say, and who declares, instead of one small step for man, one great leap for mankind, says this is the great step forward for the Marxist-Leninist view of history, sort of thing. And so the Americans are quite rightly pissed off, and then the race continues really between the two nations, and it's not too bad. The first couple of episodes are pretty good. The second episode features Wernher von Braun in particular, and his exposure in Congress as being involved in the death camps and so on at Peenemünde, and the building of the V1 and V2 rockets during the Second World War. And so he's taken off the space program, which I think pretty much happened in real life, didn't it? But well done in the TV series anyway. So that's good, but I'm only three episodes in. Yeah, go on.
So it's alternate history then?
Yeah, alternate history, yeah. It's a bit like The Calculating Stars, which I think I mentioned when we were talking about that book. It has some similarities to that, but not too many, I don't think. And I think the thing about female astronauts is going to become a big part of the story, but I haven't got there yet.
Do they give you any indication of what the turning point?
Well, it's really simply the fact that the Russians landed on the moon first. They had a secret program to get an astronaut there before, a cosmonaut there before the Americans to one up the Americans, and that's really the turning point. And then everything follows on from that.
The Russians in the 1960s had their major designer of their Russian space program, Sergei Korolev, died quite young. I think he was only about 60, and he died in about 1966. Mm-hmm. And the Russian space program sort of went off the rails after that. They kept on going. I think his assistant carried on to do the work for Korolev, but he just didn't have the drive, and he didn't have the charisma, and he didn't have the knowledge of the connections both up and down for the space program, which is a bit like what Wernher von Braun did. So this guy, Korolev, is the exact Soviet counterpart for Wernher von Braun. And because this guy died, I'm wondering whether that's the point where this guy doesn't die, but he stays there and just keeps on going and keeps on pushing it.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the premise. It certainly hasn't been spelled out in the series so far, but still, it's been pretty good so far. I'll be interested to see where they go with it and see what happens. Yeah, that's good.
I'll keep an eye out for it.
Yeah. The Hugo Time Machine. And this time we're going to be featuring 1958, I believe, And yes. We have some interesting books here. The best novel was The Big Time, which I think last time we spoke you hadn't actually managed to push your way through to finish. Did you actually finish The Big Time?
Yes, I have finished it now.
By Fritz Leiber. What did you think?
Go on. I was actually a bit amazed that I'd always thought, I've read a bit of Fritz Leiber, and I've always thought of him as being mainly a fantasy or a suspense horror writer, really.
Yeah, yeah.
The two major things that I know him for are the Farfadet and Grey Mouser stories, which are basically sword and sorcery style, companions on the road out, you know, one's a swordsman and one's a thief. Set in a nondescript medieval landscape, which are pretty damn good. They pretty much set the scene for that companions on the road, sword and sorcery sort of stuff from way back. And the other one that I know him for is the fantastic novel Our Lady of Darkness, which he wrote in his later years, set in San Francisco, which I thought was an excellent book, probably a winner of a major award, or it should have been because it was so bloody good. But I don't know Leiber very much for science fiction. But it's interesting that this one was, we're talking about Hugo Awards that were presented at the 1958 Worldcon, it's the 16th, that was held in Los Angeles. Guest of honour was Richard Matheson from I Am Legend fame.
Uh-huh.
And so it's interesting that The Big Time by Fritz Leiber was published in Galaxy in March and April 1958.
Yeah, it's strange.
So they still haven't quite got their acts together even in 1958. But they've been going, the Hugos have been running for 3, 4, 5, 8 years by this stage. And they still haven't worked out that the best thing to do is to have it for the calendar year of the previous calendar year and just set it at that. So we still haven't quite got ourselves set up properly, but it's still worthwhile having a look at the Hugos and the novels that won them in that time.
Yeah,
I thought the first part. I spoke to you about this at some stage when we were talking about reviewing this, and I remember saying that I tried to read this a couple of times previously, and just could not get into it at all.
Yeah.
And I struggled this time as well. And it is a difficult book to get a hold of because it reads like the script for a play to me.
Isn't it very much like a play? It's like a one act play set in one single environment, and characters come in from stage left and stage right. And go off again, but it's all this particular one scene in this little bubble of space time, supposedly.
Yep.
But it's kind of like a one act play. It could easily, I'd be surprised if it hasn't been turned into a play, because it has that sort of feel to it. But it's very tedious, isn't it, to begin with? It's all this setup, and the other thing which I always find very hard is a male writer trying to write from a female's point of view in the first person. It's very rare that that works.
And I don't think he pulls it off.
He does not pull it off. No, it's not good at all. And so there's really only one kind of idea to it. Well, I don't know. It's a strange sort of book because it doesn't really conclude with anything. There's lots of talking about how terrible war is and so on, and then there's a bit of blather at the end about whether this war that they're in, which is a time war, through changing time all over the place, whether this isn't a new part of evolution for mankind and stuff. I gave it two stars on Goodreads.
I gave it three, but that was because I was generous, and it was a bare three. It wasn't going to go any higher than three. And look, I don't, from the evidence of this, I don't think that Leiber basically was too good at the science fiction side of things. I think he would have been better off staying in the fantasy and horror or fantasy and suspense sort of style.
Yeah. Before we move on, actually, I should mention that The Big Time, one of the interesting things about The Big Time is that, as far as I know, it's the only Hugo novel winner which is now in the public domain. And in fact, it's available from Standard eBooks, which is an organisation I've mentioned before and who I do quite a bit of work for. So, if you want to read it for free, it's there on Standard eBooks.
But it's interesting to see what this was up against. Or no, actually, the interesting thing is there are no nominees.
No nominees.
There's no nominees
anyway,
at all.
No,
there's none that are listed. But let me give you a list of some of the books that were published in that year. Jack Vance's Big Planet, not one I know.
Yeah, wasn't that great?
Phil Dick did two, Cosmic Puppets and Eye in the Sky.
Yeah, so very early Dick, that would be.
Neither of which are top ranked Dick. Bradbury's Dandelion Wine.
Yeah, which is not really science fiction. Not science fiction at all, really, if I remember.
No, well, okay, but, you know, we're talking here about, don't forget that we are allowing for the fact that the Hugo Awards are able to nominate pretty much anything.
Yeah, but it's not in fantasy. It's not science fiction or fantasy, Dandelion Wine.
But
it's by Bradbury. It's by Bradbury, therefore...
Exactly, if it's by Bradbury, it fits. You know, we basically drag it into the genre. Arthur C. Clarke's The Deep Range.
Not one of his better ones either.
Not high-level Clarke. Highline had two books, Door into Summer and Citizen of the Galaxy.
No, they're not so bad.
Citizen of the Galaxy is not so bad. Door into Summers is a bit... Door into Summers is one of those ones where it's... isn't this the one where it's a fantasy where he goes into a another realm and he basically tries to...
No, I don't know that that's...
How can I put this? He tries to have sexual intercourse with just about everything that moves,
I think. Well, that sounds like Highline, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, that sounds like Highline. So this is an early indicator. Citizen of the Galaxy, I think, was pretty good.
Would you call it a young adult, one of his young adult books, you know, or his juvenile books?
Which one? Citizen of the Galaxy?
Citizen of the Galaxy.
Yeah, basically.
Isn't it about a young slave boy?
Yeah, I think so. Hoyle released The Black Cloud.
Yep. Oh, that is a good book.
Now, here's three that are interesting. John Wyndham, The Midwich Cuckoos.
Yeah, which is good.
Neville Shute, On the Beach.
Very good.
Yes, but I don't reckon that anybody at the Worldcon would have actually picked that or twigged that as being science fiction.
No, probably not.
It certainly would not have been released as a science fiction novel. Yeah. So not at all.
So do you think maybe that year was just that the Americans weren't paying any attention to what was being written outside of America? Because both of the other two books you mentioned were...
You could say that, David. I couldn't possibly comment.
Well, it's a thought, isn't it? Really,
but the last one...
Certainly the Black Cloud by Fred Hoyle is, I think, a very good book.
But the last one, Eric Frank Russell's Wasp.
I don't know that, but you obviously do.
Oh, I love this book. I think this is a really, truly excellent book. It's really funny. It's a classic Eric Frank Russell, John W. Campbell book where this guy basically, Earthman is put in as an infiltration agent into an alien planet. He's had to have his whole body rearranged to make it purple with big ears and all the rest of it to make him so that he can fit in. And he basically acts as a terrorist inside on this alien planet. And, of course, everything works for him. Mm-hmm. Nothing ever goes wrong for him, but he gets it all done. There's an interesting story, go back to Neil Gaiman again, there's an interesting story that Gaiman... around about 99, 2000, actually had owned the rights to this particular book in order to write a screenplay for it.
Yeah.
But when 9/11 happened, he decided that it probably wasn't the best time.
Yeah.
Wasn't a good idea.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, we missed out on it. It's a funny book, certainly worthwhile reading. I always like it. You know, we've always got those books that we read way back when, which we have a soft spot for. Go back and read them again, and you go, yeah, I don't know why I like this as much as I did last time. So anyway, that's the novels.
That's the novel, yeah. Okay. And then we've got a short story, which is quite fun, Or All the Seas with Oysters by Avram Davidson. But that's one of those one idea punchline type of stories, isn't it?
I think it's a very forgettable story. It's funny. You read it once, you go, yep, okay, read it, and that's it. It's odd that it actually appeared in Galaxy. You sort of wonder whether, because it strikes me as being a fairly classic Campbell story, and it could very well have appeared in Astounding.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing that you sort of wonder whether Davidson actually submitted it to Astounding first and got rejected. Don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, went on to win the
Hugo.
Win the Hugo Award.
Yeah, there we go. But basically, just those people who haven't read it, it's this basic concept of there are two characters in a bicycle shop. And the punchline really is that that one of them really comes up with this theory that there are aliens masquerading as inanimate objects like safety pins and coat hangers and so on, and that in fact there's an evolutionary cycle that these beings go through, and they start as safety pins, and they metamorphose into coat hangers. And then into bicycles, and it's a kind of funny kind of idea, but it's just a one-off sort of idea. So there we go.
It's that classic 1950s science fiction story where it's just one joke and that's
it. Yeah, that's right. And then we come to the movie, The Incredible Shrinking Man, 1957. Now, you mentioned that the guest of honor was Richard Matheson, and in fact, this is The Incredible Shrinking Man is based on. He wrote the screenplay based on a novel he wrote. So, but yet we know Matheson better as the author of I Am Legend, which is really about the concept of the last man in the world, and everyone else has come down with some sort of vampire plague, and he has to defend himself. And it's been made into a movie like four times. Yeah,
four. Wow. Yeah.
The last one with Will Smith, and that's. But anyway, it's quite a clever. It's a simple sort of concept movie. The main character, whose name is Grant Williams, is on a boat somewhere, and he falls under a cloud of radioactive material from some sort of bomb test, and this somehow causes him to start shrinking, and he just gets a little bit short. He finds himself losing weight, and so he goes to the doctor, and the doctor finds he's also losing height. As well as weight, which is very unusual, and slowly this guy gets smaller and smaller and smaller until he's the size of a toddler, and his wife has to sort of look after him as though he were a toddler, and so on. And there's a lot of set creation to make it to appear that he's the size that he's meant to be, but it's quite good in that he keeps going smaller and smaller and smaller, and ends up having to live in a doll's house. And if you're an arachnophobe, you do not want to see this movie, because there are a number of episodes where he has to fight this gigantic spider, tarantula-like spider, which is bigger than he is, as he gets smaller and smaller. But he keeps on getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and then it just sort of finishes with a sort of very, what would you say, philosophical sort of thing. As he gets smaller, he's sort of looking up at the stars and thinking about his place in the universe, and thinking maybe he'll keep getting smaller and then he'll join up and start becoming big again. The small and the big will rejoin. So I'm being a bit cynical about it, but it sort of fades away with this sort of very philosophical statement at the end. You know, he sort of says, as I felt my body dwindling, melting, becoming nothing, my fears melted away, and in their place came acceptance. All this vast majesty of creation, it had to mean something. And then I met something too. Yes, smaller than the smallest, I meant something too. To God there is no zero. I still exist. which is a bit overwrought, I think, but it's all right. What you've got to say, of course, is the special effects are of their time, and so by modern standards it's absolutely crummy. Oh, but there's some clever bits in it. So they've done some clever set building, like the doll's house and the slightly smaller furniture in the slightly bigger furniture in the house in that while he's going to that sort of phase. And then the doll's house episodes, and some quite clever bits where they mix him up with a cat and this gigantic spider. So it's pretty well done. It's well enough done for the time, I think. So whether it deserves a Hugo, it probably did, because there wasn't probably a lot of competition at the time for something like that. But I quite enjoyed watching it again. I saw it ages ago, but I watched it again for the purpose of the podcast. So that was that. You haven't seen the movie?
Nope. I'm starting to think it's probably a good idea that I don't.
Yeah, I wouldn't bother. I mean, that's the whole concept, is he just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. I mean, there's a couple of bits where I thought that the character the actor playing the character, who was, let me look it up, Scott Carey, who plays Grant Williams, was kind of really petulant. He puts on this really petulant sort of thing, and he has these arguments with his wife, which seem very unfair. But that's about all you can say about it. So yeah, I wouldn't bother going hunting it up. But strangely enough, it's not like available anywhere. I mean, you can get it, you can pay for it on Apple iTunes, but it's not available on any of the streaming services or anything like that. So it's actually not that easy to get a hold of.
All right, David. Well, look, good talking to you again.
Yep.
We'll catch up again in a couple of weeks. Hopefully we'll get back onto schedule.
Yep.
And we'll work it out.
Indeed. Okay. See you then.
All right. See you, David. Okay. Thanks very much. Okay. Bye.
Bye.